previously.tvpodcastnetwork.
This is a dream. Here, it has to be.
It's more like a eternal waking nightmare from which there is no escape.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 185 for the week of January 1st, 2018. Yeah. I am the Meta David T. Cole Museum, David T. Cole, and I'm here with Update Vortex, Sarah D. Bunting.
98%, Captain.
Morbidly overprotective mother, Tara Ariano.
Please drink your totally innocent smoothie.
And optimistic hit and runner, Nick Reinwell Jones.
This is going to work out great for us. You'll see.
Hello, everybody. Happy New Year. And welcome back to Extra Hot Great. We are joined this week by Nick Reinwell Jones. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
Yay! Nick!
Wonderful to be rising back almost his, a year later.
Yeah. Rising from his deathbed with a box of Ludens to talk about Black Mirror. Which is back. It's on Netflix. If you're not familiar with the series, get familiar. It's great. Basically, the brief is like, what would you guys say? Sci-fi set in the near future and designed to
technology. Twilight Zone with more technology. Yeah.
So we have all seen the entire latest season, and we thought that we would discuss the episodes in order of least to most favorite collectively of all of us. We all submitted lists to Dave and he ran some numbers, and so we're going to talk about them in that order. Dave, any comments on the tabulations? Any surprises?
Only that weirdly, we're going to talk about them from least to most liked, but we all agreed on number one, and oddly, we all agreed on the penultimate worst episode, like the second to last, we also agreed on, which was kind of weird. But otherwise, a couple outliers, but general, overall, fuzzy agreement.
Yeah. Okay.
Is how I would put it.
So shall we start with? Shall we get into it then?
Yes. All right. So, our least favorite episode of season four, that is to say ranked number six, is actually the season capper called The Black Museum. It's sort of a meta story for the season. It was kind of a weird departure, I thought, for the series and not all that successful. Does anybody want to take a crack at the very quick synopsis of the story or at least the setup?
Sure. I'll say this first. We when we got the screeners, they were not numbered. We didn't find out. Dave had to like Google and find a tweet that told us what order you're supposed to watch them in or what order they will have been numbered for you by the time they drop on Netflix. For us, they were just in alpha order. So if you for Nick and Sarah, if they didn't know that and to watch this one first or second or whatever, it would be really weird because it has references to other episodes.
I went on IMDb to see what order it was supposed to be in, which was mostly right, but not totally right.
Wasn't right. Cause yeah, that's what I was judging by too. Yeah.
Yeah. I found a tweet by the creator. So I figured that was probably.
I started watching Black Museum and then realized, oh wait, I need to watch this one last. Cause clearly it's referring to other ones.
Yeah. Anyways.
It's like the series is already an anthology and this episode was like an anthology within an anthology kind of, yeah. I mean, the stories ended up being linked sort of, but they really just seemed like they were stubs of sketches of ideas that they hadn't fully fleshed out and were like vaguely linked. You know, it made sense in the end, but it was the least, it was definitely the least satisfying because for me, it was the most episodic within itself.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, totally.
Well,
agree.
The narrator, well, who we think is sort of the narrator, like he's, you know, on screen, but sort of your guide to the Black Museum is like, this one was really a lot of interesting premises, all of which ended up being more telling than showing, like way more. And that the writing for that guy, the quote unquote owner of the Black Museum, was like, he just was a little folksy and pleased with his own metaphors. And for that reason, that one was like a little difficult to plug into. You know, just seemed, it seemed longer than it actually was. There were a couple of like spine chilling moments, like that last "the monkey needs a hug" was like, oh God, that was roof. But yeah, it just felt, it felt like leftovers that they tried to make into one thing, and it,
yeah,
I'm not sure it succeeded.
It was the Chex Mix of Black Mirror.
Yeah, the idea was it was about the process of putting someone's consciousness, like removing it from their bodies if they've had some kind of catastrophic accident, and putting it into another thing where, like, either a person or an object, and
Yeah, it had too much going on, and yet not enough going on at the same time.
Yeah, although it does tie into the over art, what kept coming up as a theme in this season, which is the idea of being trapped, you're having a consciousness trapped somewhere with no hope of escape, or as I tweeted at the time, this season of Black Mirror is about how there are many fates worse than death. Happy holidays.
Totally. Like,
interestingly enough, before we move on, just because we do have six episodes to cover, so let's spend more time on the ones we liked. But this was the one we agreed on. This is everybody's second least favorite episode, but scoring came in last.
Okay.
So a little interesting, a little bit of math.
My other complaint about that one was there are multiple characters playing Americans, even though they're British actors.
Yes.
Greater or less degrees of accent success.
Yes.
The guy from Catastrophe, who's already terrible on that show, was an American doctor in this one and still has not mastered his American accent. Like, you have Americans in other episodes. Just what's the, I don't know why sometimes they're allowed and sometimes they aren't. Sorry. Yeah. Go ahead, Nick.
To agree with you on that, like, I don't want to be accused of being a racist here, but I just think there are some people that you look at them and you can already tell that they're British.
100%.
Like, the doctor is one of them. And as soon as he starts talking, I'm like, nope. And yeah, if they're going to have American actors playing Americans, don't mix it up with like British people. Like, come on.
Yeah. We can always tell.
Yeah.
Okay. Our second least favorite episode is an episode called Crocodile, which actually was a little all over the map as far as our scoring goes. We had two least favorites, a third fave and a fourth fave here. So, Tara, I believe you were in the least favorite camp. So you want to take a crack at Crocodile, what it was and why you didn't think it was.
Sure. I think I had this one ranked my fourth least favorite. It was in my bottom half for the season. This is a story of...
I'm reading by points. Sorry. Yeah.
Okay. A couple is driving somewhere. They hit a biker. They hide his body. Many years later, the woman in this couple, she's not with him anymore, is played by Andrea Riseborough of many things you've seen. Basically, the guy that she was seeing at the time, her accomplice in this, comes back into her life, and she ends up, it turns into, like, she just has to kill everybody who knows about this thing happening. But what she doesn't realize is that she's in a hotel room when she kills this guy. In the street below, a totally unrelated person gets run over by what I call pizza red box, like a food unmanned food truck. The person who's investigating the incident for an insurance company has access to a device that lets you sort of access memories that you didn't consciously necessarily know you had. And she reconstructs the accident. This woman ends up getting implicated in it. And, she's run out of ideas other than killing people. So it just sort of escalates.
As have the writers.
Right. It escalates into greater and greater absurdity.
Yeah, and it's basically just a near future procedural.
Yeah.
You know, we have access to fuzzy memory recording, and then there's a twist at the end where she thinks she's got away with it because she's killed all the witnesses, including a little kid, a little baby, and by the way, you know, if you haven't watched, you know, and you're listening, why? But here we go. And right at the very end, we find out that the pet that was introduced, you know, Chekhov's hamster or guinea pig that was introduced in Act One was sitting right next to the baby that she was her last victim. And, you know, the act out is basically them, you know, grabbing the guinea pig to do the fuzzy memory technique. And that's the show. So it all kind of hinges on that. I mean, I actually kind of enjoyed the detective work stuff in this. Like, it wasn't great, but it was interesting. You mm-hmm. know, and I was kind of like, you know, it was a minor take. You know, like if there's major episodes and minor episodes of Black Mirror, this is definitely the minor episode. This is, you know, the equivalent of Sherlock's, you know, odd numbered episodes, the ones that are like okay but not great. And after you've produced an hour of television like the National Anthem, you can't really do this and expect the same sort of impact as far as like, you know, a big twist, a big event, and expect to really get juice out of it. I enjoyed the ride, but it doesn't really compare to other.
I thought, I mean, the guinea pig reveal was what made it what bumped it up a spot probably in my rankings, because I thought that was great. But who had it ranked the highest?
I think probably me.
Oh
yeah, I did. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I had it last. I didn't dislike it. I just felt like I don't see why this is particularly Black Mirror-y, yeah. except mm-hmm. for the, I mean, I do, but then it just like, it's
well, there was no reason. But like the actual technology of extracting memories from these people, like it isn't really like that could have just been rewritten as actual witness events. Right. And then the story would be almost the same, you know, except for the guinea pig twist, like the actual ride you're on as far as learning who did what, when, where, and sort of the connections and, you know, following the roadmap, the, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4 of all the witnesses, you know, that part, it doesn't really come into play until the very end as far as affecting the story.
Yeah, I don't know. I felt like I had seen this already. It was called Fortitude. It had Stanley Tucci instead of the lady who played Wallace Simpson in that Madonna-directed movie. She mm-hmm. was fine in that, but I don't know. It just felt inessential. Like it was fine. I'm not mad at it, but I don't care. I kept forgetting actually what this one was about.
Yeah.
This crocodile. Why?
Yeah. I don't know why it's called crocodile either. But I was going to say, it's like, to me, it reminded me of Fargo, because you've got like the mm-hmm. snowy landscape. You've got the like not completely evil person, but definitely flawed person that keeps killing people. And then you have like the earnest married woman that is just pursuing the case until she gets the person.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's true.
Yeah, true.
It's Iceland Fargo. Yeah. All right. Anything else to say on Crocodile?
Nope.
All right. So. Number four is Metalhead. Metalhead. And this was highly ranked by Sarah, I believe, right?
Yes, it was.
So why don't you give us an idea what the episode is?
Well, basically, we start out, this is in black and white, this one. We start out with like a team of, you know, post-apocalyptic folks on a mission to get something that, you know, the MacGuffin. What it turns out to be is, of course, highly ironic, but basically they're breaking into a warehouse, but there is a rogue dog, or like a drone that's sort of in the shape of a dog. And these things are like just trained to pursue until death, either theirs or their human targets. We seem to be in some kind of post-pulse landscape. There aren't a lot of people around. Like wherever the hero goes, we're to assume that she's confident that there's just not going to be living people. She's always right about that. This actor, whose name I have forgotten, was in that miniseries Three Girls. About sex trafficking outside of Manchester. She was excellent in that, and she's excellent here. I just thought it was really this thrilling journey of her like climbing trees to get away from this drone, waiting for its battery to go down, and then it's like inexorably tracking her on three legs, and then she's in the house and trying to MacGyver, you know, trying to get the car keys and trying to MacGyver like weaponry together, and she's been injured. I don't know. I thought it was effective. I actually thought the last reveal that what they were trying to get all along was teddy bears was like, okay, like that was a little much, but it was very short for an episode of Black Mirror comparatively. And it was a real nail biter. And I like her a lot. I thought her reactions were very naturalistic and relatable. Apparently that was just me though.
I was into it when at the reveal, like, ooh, what's this all about? And then it was just, oh, okay, it's just a chase episode. That's all it was. Like, I didn't really understand what the Black Mirror-y part of it was. I mean, obviously the dog and the surveillance state and all that, but it really was just like this vignette out of time. And like, it was interesting, and the hunting stuff was tense, but I just like, much like the other episode, I was just like, well, this doesn't feel like the Black Mirror quotient is low on this one. I thought,
it was no twist.
It was just like, here's this dog and it's coming for you. And like the teddy bear thing at the end, I'm like, that was like, what? Like, just tell the
Because I kept thinking that we were going to get some kind of reveal about like why all this was happening. And instead it's just like, here's your reveal, teddy bears.
I mean, that was a little faux Henry for me. I did like that there was this sort of like not even reference exactly, but like this top note of There Will Come Soft Rains, the Ray Bradbury story about the house that just keeps, it's fully automated, just keeps going after there's been a nuclear strike. That, I don't know, like after, they seem to be living in like this post-technological, post-humanity world, but there's like no one left who knows how to turn off the dogs. So yeah. I don't know. I liked that, that referent, but
yeah,
I see what you're saying.
I didn't think it was a bad story. I just thought it was like a weird choice for Black Mirror. That's all. Like,
yeah,
like
it was, no, I can see that.
Well, I suspect it's in black and white because it really probably made the CG and the dog blended a lot better.
Yeah.
That's my take on it. Aww. Like, I didn't really see why it was CG, why it was black and white otherwise.
I ranked this one last. To me, it doesn't matter what happened to cause all this. Like, it's, you know, it's the apocalypse and it's terrible. And that's why when she broke into the house and the owners were had shotgun themselves, I was like, yep, that's aren't they not? Are they not better off? Lady from Three Girls. I don't know who that was. but as soon as we saw the dog, I also went Robo Puppy commands kill from the Futurama episode with Robo Puppy.
Commands three thing decade I thought long was kill spree.
The one thing I thought was interesting about this one, plus actually all of also the Black Museum and Crocodile a little bit too, I guess, is like these, all three of these are the only ones that the only Black Mirror episodes I can remember offhand as having any kind of critique of like economic systems at all. Like the Black Museum, it hinges on using impoverished American people in a horrible already existing dystopic system of healthcare to experiment on them, essentially. And Crocodile wouldn't work if not for, they include a line about it's just been made illegal to refuse to talk to an insurance investigator. So that's already like laws have been enacted to protect capital. And that's what's happening in Metalhead too, where they've created these essentially a robot to protect this warehouse that has the capacity to kill on site and like many ways to do it.
Will not take my teddy bears.
Right. So that was interesting to me, but the rest of it was just like A, slow, and B, why are you trying to survive the apocalypse? This sucks.
Anything else on Metalhead?
I don't think so.
Nope.
No.
Okay. Number three, this is the Jodie Foster directed Archangel. And Tara was talking about morbidly overprotective mothers in the intro. Mm-hmm. This is that episode. Tara, do you want to take a quick crack at the episode synopsis here?
Sure. Rosemary DeWitt plays a single mom. She is her kid at some point early in the story runs away from the park. She's followed a cat. And so she decides she needs to have some kind of electronic tether on her. And so she brings the kid in, whose name is Sarah, in for to be part of an experimental trial, I guess, of a system where you chip the kid, and then you have a mobile device, like a iPad type of thing, where you can enact various controls on the kid. You can, if their cortisol level is rising, you can make it so that their vision actually filters out, and their ears as well. Filters
see
out
what they see.
Yeah, she can see. The mom can like access the kid's eyes essentially, and like just follow her around. But she can also limit what she can see that might upset her, like
it's
a
like
scary
a
barking
for your actual child instead of your TV.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is not the best, because you can't. You know, the lesson that she learns early on is like, maybe this filtering software is not great because it's making it so. There's a lot of stuff my kid can't see and understand and deal with, like when her grandpa has a stroke in front of her, and that's upsetting, obviously. And so she turns it off, but then maybe she turns it on. My problem with this, I thought it was well done. But my complaint to Dave was like, why would you need a separate device for this that should integrate with your existing tech? Which, yeah, I know is not true. The lesson you're supposed to learn, but was also the first thing I thought.
Well, first of all, before we get into the actual discussion, I just want to say that Black Mirror and Jodie Foster missed a great opportunity to title this episode Panic Womb.
Yeah.
Nice.
Thank you. You know, I like these episodes. So for me, there's like the weaker Black Mirror episodes are the ones that are, here's this thing going on. It doesn't quite make sense. I wonder what the setting is that will make it all make sense. And the next episode we'll talk about is one of those. And this one, I like it. And ones that I like are like, here's the technological element, and this is how it affects this story, rather than here's the story, and at the end, this was the technology behind it.
Yeah.
I generally find ones like Archangel work better than, say, now I'm the outlier here on the next one, which is what I'm talking about, Hang the DJ, but there's been others like it where it's like, here's a story and here's the Law and Order twist that is technology. This one I liked because it was a story about like helicopter mothers with ultimate power and then how it screws up the kid, how that kid copes at school, you know, how that mother, I was saying at one point, the mother like keeps on like, I'm not going to use this. I'm going to put it in the attic. And it was like almost note for note, the same as the kids in the hall, Dave Foley really wants to eat chocolate at night skit, where he throws it in the garbage. He comes and picks it back up. He's like, oh no, I ate more chocolate, and puts it back in the garbage, throws lye on top of it, comes back an hour later, washes the lye off of it. It's like that, except instead of chocolate, it's watching your kid do everything.
Everything. Yikes.
Yeah, like everything, like the kids having sex, she's doing coke and all this crazy stuff. It was an interesting, you know, treatise on helicopter parenting gone mad and not having a kid. I enjoyed it. And I enjoyed that at the end, the kid just hitchhikes off to her doom, and it's all mom's fault. Way to go, mom. Oh, and also Da Vinci from Canada's in it. Hi, Da Vinci.
What do our fellow non-parents think, Nick?
So this is an example of like where I haven't seen that many Black Mirror episodes, but I feel like the weaker ones, I don't know if this makes sense. It's like, they don't really go beyond giving you a premise. Like they don't kind of like start with a premise and then keep like twisting it in different directions. Like this one, I feel like it's just the same premise from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. And that made it a little less satisfying to me. Like Nosedive, for example, like gives you a premise of like, okay, everybody's rating each other on their phones. And then it just keeps like twisting it off in all these different directions that you don't expect. So it ends up somewhere really interesting. But this one, it's just like, nothing really happens in it that you couldn't sort of predict from the beginning. And I mean, I guess it's more about like the social message of it than being an like interestingly like twisty thriller episode, but it left me a little cold because of that.
Yeah, it definitely is it's a slow ride, but you kind of see where it's going, I guess. Yeah, I can see that.
Like, oh, she's going to be mad at the mother for doing that? Oh, gee, what a surprise. You know? Like, and also, by the way, this is like between this and Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, I hope like every daughter is going to be very wary of drinking any smoothie type thing that their mother gives them for a while.
Yeah.
Sarah, what did you think of Archangel?
I thought this was the first one, so I did watch it first, and I enjoyed it, but then as the season was going on, it sort of like went down in my rankings, not because of anything that it did wrong necessarily. I thought that it raised some interesting issues, but like it was a little bit, you know, look at us raising some interesting issues, and it could have been tightened up a little bit, but you could also sort of tell that this was going to be the one that was directed by Jodie Foster, because this was definitely an actor's director job of directing.
That's true.
Which is fine, but I think if you're like, this is a little bit more of a like genre, of a genre show, and it probably could have been a little more disciplined. Like I liked these actors fine, but you know, like let's get to the ironic doom button, shall we? I mean, it was good.
Yeah, sometimes a Black Mirror episode, when it is sort of like this one, where the technological aspect is presented up front and then you just see the story play out because that is in this world, sometimes an hour feels like too much. Like I felt like maybe even Metalhead was the same. Like it was like really long chase scene. Like, did it need to be that long? You know, like the story would have been the same if it was in half an hour. I feel like maybe this one you're having the same reaction to it, which makes sense to me.
Yep.
Anything else on Archangel?
I might have rated it higher because it looked extremely Canadian.
Oh my gosh.
It did look very Canadian.
Yeah.
I don't know where they were. It's like Brampton or something. But yeah, it was very small town Canada.
It was a lot of beautiful, beautiful scarves, I thought.
Our number two episode is Hang the DJ. This got a couple number two votes, a number three vote, and I voted at number four. So I guess I was the most down in this.
Go ahead, Nick. You tell us.
Okay, so starts off, it looks like, you know, to paraphrase Mallory Ortberg, what if Tinder, but too much. people are like, literally, you have a piece of technology that just tells you who to go on a date with. It tells you how long you're going to be in a relationship with that person. So it might be 12 hours, it might be 5 years, but like you have to stay with this person and basically do what the app tells you until your expiration date. And then you move on to another person. And the idea is that through all of these things, the system, which is just called the system, is like creating your perfect match over time. So like after enough of these, it will say, this is your soulmate. And then you go off with your soulmate and you're supposed to be incredibly happy. And over the course of the episode, you just see more and more of like the controls on this society. Like they're actually like in a walled like city, or where I don't know exactly how big it is, but like you can't leave the walls. You have to just stay here and keep doing what the thing tells you to do, or like scary men will come and talk you into behaving. And ultimately there are the first couple that we meet that are on the 12-hour date, they really like each other, and it's like a little bit awkward, but you can see they really like each other. And then like as soon as they're paired off with different people, they gradually become like kind of wistful about not being together. And then once eventually they do get back together, but there's like a rule that you can't look at how long you're going to be together unless both partners agree. But the guy is like so into this woman that he really needs to know. So like the system, this is like my only issue with the episode. Like for some reason, the system lets him do this.
That good point. That bugged me too.
Cause he's like, can I just see? So they're like, both partners have to agree. And he's like, can I just see? And it's like, well, okay. And then he sees and it's going to be 5 years and he's really happy. But then it's like, oh, because only you found out, now you've like ruined the algorithm. And like now, and then it keeps like going down and down and down. And then eventually they're only together for like 20 hours. And then she finds out that he did that and she's really mad. And then they go off into other unsatisfying relationships, eventually find each other again. And they start to realize like, wait a minute, maybe the point is that we're supposed to rebel against this. Maybe this is like a simulation. And then it turns out, yes, it is a simulation. And they're all inside of like this, like they're computer simulations inside of this like Tinder system where it's playing out all of these relationships over time. And then because, and at the end you see like, oh, they this match happened 1,000 times and they rebelled 998 times to be together. So that means there's a 99.8% chance that they belong together. And then you see them getting together in the real world.
Yeah, their life was the matching algorithm. That's the thing. That's why I didn't like it. It's like, all right, these people are dating. All right, here we go. What's up? Oh, it's a dating program next.
Yeah, this is one of several episodes this season where there's an idea of like a consciousness can be duplicated and things can happen with that. Maybe something good, usually something bad. This is the happy ending. And this is like as close as this season gets to like a San Junipero where you feel good at the end of it. I mean, USS Callister, which we're about to get to, also like has a semi happy ending, but yeah, I just like this one. It was sweet. I thought the actors were really well cast. The banter that they wrote for them was good. And what irritated them about their bad matches was funny to me, mm-hmm. especially the second one the guy gets matched with. Hates him on set.
Oh, that was so great.
Terrible.
He's like, can I just say something? No.
Yeah. Like that? Not really. She's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, this was very charming, mostly because of the actors. And I was glad that, you know, this was the rare Black Mirror where it seemed to have worked out in the end. Like, it was cynical about it, but at least it was kind of a positive note to go out on. The imagery of them finding themselves surrounded by all the other versions of themselves was, I mean, like, ironically, it was pretty primitive looking the way it was done, but it was also kind of pretty. But I did mark it down because it did seem to me a little bit like an attempt to recreate the magic of San Junipero, which
definitely it seemed like, yes, this is going to be our San Junipero for this season.
Yeah, which I don't blame you, but that's, you know, that was a different, you know, don't do that. Like, don't get the band back together as it were. And yeah, I also thought that Nicola, as hilarious as she was not, like, there's no way they would make him stay with her for 9 months. Like, that algorithm is terrible. Who wrote that? But it was still in my top half.
Shall we move on to number one?
Sure.
That is USS Callister. And this is the first episode of the season, I believe, by the time everybody else gets to it. Who wants to take it? Nick, why don't you explain what's going on here?
Okay, so we begin seeing like this very cheesy, clearly Star Trek knockoff starring Jesse Plemons and some other actors, well, including Jimmy Simpson from Westworld, which becomes a very interesting meta note. But at first it just looks like, okay, what's this going to be? We're just seeing like this Star Trek knockoff. And then gradually, like even in this opening clip, we see that like Jesse Plemons' character really relishes his power as the captain and is like sort of, you know, borderline abusive to the rest of the crew. Then we cut out of that. We see that this is, we see that he works at a virtual reality company. He's the chief technology officer, and he's second in command to the CEO, who is Jimmy Simpson. And basically, he's creating this virtual reality world, but he has his own version where that's like modded to be this like space fleet, which is the Star Trek knockoff, where he gets to go in and be the captain, and everybody that he works with are his underlings. But of course, the horrifying twist is, and that's one thing I really appreciate about this episode, they get to horrifying twists very early on, is that he has literally like digitally cloned all of these people. So they're fully conscious inside this system and trapped in there to just be his like toys, and they have to obey him. And Kristen Milioti comes in as a new employee. At first, it seems like she and Jesse are going to hit it off, but then Jimmy Simpson kind of like woos her away from him, which causes Jesse Plemons to say, "Oh, okay, that's it. I'm making you a clone too." She gets into the system, and then like she's the one who is really insistent, like, okay, we got to figure out a way out of this. And she kind of leads the crew in figuring out how to escape from it.
I liked that meta comment too, that she was the mother. How I Met Your
That's
Mother.
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. This, like,
legendary figure.
Yep.
And then, I don't know, it was sort of like the late entry of her into the story. And I just thought this was so well done. Like, I just loved it, like from the dialogue to like, well, there's no genitals in Space Fleet.
Once she said stealing my pussy is a direct fucking line, I was like, okay, this episode has me. No matter what happens, this is gonna be my favorite.
Like, and there's like some arachnosaurus who used to be Jillian in marketing who was to Landry at some point. And then Billy Magnuson as the nemesis, as the con, basically.
Yep.
And like whenever it's like pause game, they're all just talking to each other and like Jillian's claw gestures, which he's chit-chatting with his character. Just they thought of every single thing. And I just thought it was really great. And especially with the like cyclone of revelations that we're all living in now about workplace serial predators. I just thought this was extremely well timed, and he is not vain at all. Jesse Plemons, it's an excellent performance of a real shitty crazer, and it was great.
He really sinks his teeth into this, and he has a like a Shatnery voice that he puts on when he's being the captain and sometimes drops it. Like they're all having so much fun. That was what made it the best for me. Like, just as an actor's showcase, this gives them so much to work with. And for having only worked together on this, like, I mean, I guess it's movie length. It's the longest one at 90-ish minutes. But they have such great chemistry, like, on both sides. In the workplace, we don't see them as much. But in the Space Fleet mod, when they're which also becomes, like, you know, a horrible, shitty workplace, because they all just have to just... they have to play along or he gets mad and punishes them, like Jillian for marketing. And so they, you know,
they can't die also.
Yes.
Like they're never like Billy Magnuson's character is like, I think it would be the kind thing to kill me. And he's like, nah, you're like, oh man, how long has he been in here? Like, that's just, it's brilliant.
Yeah. I saw him in The Office and then I didn't recognize him at first in his con drag, but yes, I was glad that he was there. Dave, what did you think?
I thought this had a considerable thematic overlap with Hang the DJ, you know, digital life, where does it begin, you know, when is it protected, and you know, when does it become an ethical concern, you know, and that kind of stuff. But then like all the trappings of Star Trek put on top of it and just the pure malice of the lead, like, really makes this the most instantly accessible episode maybe of the whole series, I think. I think if I was recommending this series to somebody and I said, I think you'll like it, start with USS Callister, because I think that's like a great gateway episode and really strong on its own. But, you know, it's got the pop culture training wheels on it for you to understand what's going on, for you to kind of, you know, shorthand Cliff Notes the whole situation. And it was just so joylessly and joyfully acted all the way through. And I really just thought that Jesse Plemons, just channeling Shatner, and but also channeling butthurt neckbeard 2017 bro-ness.
Yes.
Like, was such a great combination of things to happen in one episode. Like, there's so much going on in this episode, and it all just sort of flows in and out of itself so easily.
Yeah.
And shout out to, what do you know the actress's name that is plays the Uhura?
Yeah, Michaela Cole.
Yeah, okay. She's great. She's having a good year. Yeah, she's in great. Chewing Gum, her series. She was in Last Jedi. She was in this. So it's great to see her pop up everywhere this year. I always enjoy when she's there. But yeah, this episode was like just fantastic. And the punishment for the Plemons character at the end is just like perfect, right? You know, he gets trapped in his own creation. You know, he becomes a vegetable in real life as he's trapped in like an endless void in his mind in the virtual reality, which has firewalled itself off from the launch. And the reveal when they go from when the crew they're way of escaping this hellscape is actually to commit mass suicide by driving out of a patch created wormhole that will destroy them, you know, their code. And but they do this, and through, you know, methods, they find out that they're actually in the online version of the game, not Jesse Plemons' firewalled version. And the online version of the game is J.J. Abrams' Star Trek II space.
Yes, race. Yes.
Yeah. Which was a fun little thing. And then they meet.
And then they're like harassed by Jesse Pinkman. Basically. Yep. Yeah. I was so was proud of myself that I was like, oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. The only thing that was missing was that character played by Aaron Paul, like, called them, like, terrible things. Like, that's the only thing that was missing from that online segment. Like, being the person that plays a lot of online PC games, that, like, you hear a lot of N words, a lot of F words. You know, I guess they want to keep it a little clean. But yeah, great episode.
I'll also say it's a Christmas episode. It's a Christmas movie. You can add it to your list because the patch comes out on Christmas Eve.
Yep.
That's right.
It was great. They really, I think Sarah said they thought of everything and they did. Like, they came up with this premise and they exploited it in every possible way they could. Like, they wrung every joke and every thought experiment out of this premise. It's just, it's so complete.
I like the setup of the rich guy's house. Like, here's a guy that has more money than taste and obviously he had somebody design it for him. Like, that is not his work. But then, like, there is the $4,000 display case for his Space Fleet action figure setup. Like, it's so I've worked with so many of those people, you know, and it was just like a perfect note.
And he only ever spends any time at his desk, like, playing the game. The rest of the apartment is like not been untouched.
I suspect that character was modeled off the guy who created Minecraft.
Nice.
Yeah, because he creates this little game. It goes crazy. He sells it to Microsoft for $1 billion. And now there's all these stories about, you know, oh, I'm so sad now because I'm all alone and all in my giant, you know, Brentwood mansion and stuff.
Well,
so.
Yeah, he's also like a men's rights activist or something. So like sometimes we bring heartache on ourselves. Minecraft guy.
That's why I think that DNA might be in this character.
Yeah, for sure.
But yeah, I really enjoyed this episode. I think it's like it might be my number two episode after National Anthem.
It feels like the only one that I would return to watch again after the end of this season. It's definitely the most well executed, I think.
Yeah, I kind of wondering when they're kind of going to run out of ideas that are like directly attached to like current technological trends, because I feel like they're kind of on repeat with some of these, you know, with you know, the notion of being a simulation with, you know, and stuff like that, I find is bubbling up quite a few times over the series. And, you know, like, does the series have a limited shelf life, you know, just because they're, you know, their stories are so limited?
You know, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would keep, even if you are seeing some repeats, which I think you are, vis-a-vis Hang the DJ and San Junipero, I'm okay with that because they get such good talent around it, and like the sort of the Star Trek take is not anything new.
No,
but they did it so well. Like, I think that there's still room for the series to if they do it as thoroughly as they did it in USS Callister, I think there's still room for the series to have something to say about this stuff, even if it's not like, even if it's not a headline. It's still watchable.
I hope so, because I really do enjoy it. When it's on fire, really on fire.
Well, and the great thing about it is that, like, you never, like, with a lot of shows, you know, like, okay, they're going to get to, like, a happy or satisfying ending somehow. But this show will deliver such horribly unsatisfying endings sometimes that, like, that always keeps you. It's like, okay, well, is this going to be, like, when you're watching Hang the DJ, you're going to be like, well, is this going to be like San Junipero? Or is it going to be the horrible version where they're like, you know, what is the worst possible dating fate you can imagine times a million, and that's where it's going to end or something, you know? Like, it's like, that's what I kept thinking. I was like, oh, he's, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
In front of a guinea pig.
They killed a blind baby also. Yeah. We didn't mention
that. Oh my God. Right, that was the good piece of irony
there. Yeah. Like, you didn't even need to kill the baby. You needed to kill the guinea pig, not the baby.
Words to live by. All right. It's time to go around the dial. First stop, Tara Ariano.
I would like to talk about Grown-ish, which is the Black-ish spinoff, basically the Black-ish version of A Different World, which follows Zoe to college. Like so many TV characters before her, she is attending California University. If you're listening to this podcast the day it comes out, this episode will, this series will premiere tonight on Freeform.
California University. Go Generics.
It's often Go Condors, like, even across different shows. I think it was the Condors on Fresh Prince and on 90210, but I digress. So even if you don't watch Black-ish, they were smart to put it on Freeform versus ABC because it really does feel like a reset. There's a brief moment at the beginning of the pilot where she's talking to Andre on the phone, but the rest of it is like all new. And if you didn't know anything about her character from Black-ish, it would still work, I think. And what they do very smartly in the pilot is they show a group of students, including her, obviously, in this weird midnight class, which is taught by Charlie from Black-ish, Dion Cole. It's like a midnight marketing class that primarily caters to like weird students, but also prostitutes and meth heads. We find out how all of the core kids in her friend group ended up in this terrible course because they fucked up in various ways at registration. And so that's how we get our introductions to each of them, which is very economical and smart. It's also part of a new wave of bisexual characters that is cresting on TV. We had one on Jane the Virgin. Rosa just came out as bi on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and there's a female bisexual character on this too, which is interesting. This is something that a sexuality that I don't think has been represented that much on TV, which is great and makes sense for a college age student too. They would, you know, be more free in 2017 with sexuality and not so much with the labels, blah, blah, blah. The one knock I have on it is that it's sort of reset Zoe's character. She's on Black-ish, she's extremely confident and like the coolest person in every room. And here she's more tentative and insecure. Although I guess that's something that happens in college too, where, you know, it's a reset on your personality in a lot of ways. And Yara Shahidi plays her, is still a great actor and so pretty to look at. She's very likable in this part. And they also, for a Freeform show, it's pretty adult. They get to say shit. Ooh. There's multiple episodes about drug use that they're very frank about. So it's interesting. I like that they did this with her character because it wouldn't have made sense for her to stay on Black-ish. So I'm curious to see where it goes. Grown-ish.
Wasn't the Dion Cole, I believe that whole thing where he's teaching night class is actually in Black-ish, right? I believe.
Yes, because there was last season, there was a backdoor pilot for this where it showed Zoe on a visit to this college. So that's where she found out he was teaching this class.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, that's right. Right. Yeah.
Yep.
Cool. And to plug?
Four of my plugs, Bride and Doom, the Married at First Sight podcast that Brian Rubenstein and I do, is back. If you're listening to this podcast the day it drops. Our first episode on the season 6 premiere was last night. This season they are in Boston, and like every season, the single people are like, it's really hard to date here. Like, really? Is it harder to date there than in Chicago or Miami? And no one says it's because Boston is America's most racist city. Don't at me. Ask the Spotlight team, guys. It's not me saying it. It's also me saying it. And so those will drop on Tuesday nights. And this is where we mentioned that Sarah and I will no longer be doing our Two Old Hookers podcast on Catfish, but my show-o-matics will return. And so my Catfish write-up on the season 6 or 7, whatever premiere it is, 7, the season 7. Oh my God, they're in season 7, you guys. That will drop tonight. And they say in the cold open of this season that there's going to be double the Catfish. And that seems to be true. Yes, they figured out a way to make this show even more baroque and convoluted. I'm in for the long haul. So catch my Catfish coverage on previously.tv.
Nick Reinwell Jones.
Okay, so last night I watched the first 2 episodes of Marvel's Runaways on Hulu. This is a series based on a popular comic series from Marvel, of course, about a group of teenagers who find out that their parents are all supervillains, and also that the teenagers themselves have like either some superpowers or access to super things or something, and basically have to survive and try to take down this evil organization. It was adapted for TV by Josh Schwartz and Stephanie Savage of The OC and Gossip Girl. And I think it turns out that is a really, really good marriage of writers to material. The first episode is definitely kind of slow, and it's much, much more like The OC than it is like a comic book series. but it actually really pays off because they develop the characters so much more deeply than the comic book does before they get to the first to the twist about the parents being supervillains. And I think that actually really ends up working well. From the second episode, they start getting more deeply into the mythology and everything. But now you're really kind of invested in this group of kids. And I think it's just really well done. It's a good solid teen show and a good solid comic book show. And I've read like maybe one volume of the comic. I think I have a bunch of them. I just haven't gotten to, but I've always been really curious to see how they would adapt this for TV. And I think it is a really good example of that. And I highly recommend it. For my plug, I wanted to mention, I definitely plan on bringing back more episodes of Making the Sausage, my podcast about the making of TV from the perspective of all the people who do it. I got super busy this year, and I really am into getting some more guests, so I will get my ass in gear on that and keep everyone posted via the Twitter account, and hopefully in early 2018 we'll have some new ones for you.
At Sausage Podcast.
At Sausage Podcast, yes. Follow. And and speaking of things that kept me busy all of 2017, if you live in Los Angeles and are into immersive theater or are at least curious about what immersive theater is, I have a show called Safe House 77, which is a cross between a 70s house party and a spy movie. It's for 10 audience members per night, and it's a great time. We had a sold out run at the end of this year, and we are bringing it back in March. So please, if you are interested in that, head over to safehouse77.com. You can get on the mailing list and you will get all the info when that happens.
Sweet. All right. Sarah D. Bunting, your turn.
I stopped covering The Prophet for previously.tv because we were steering into podcast territory and that did not come with us. I more or less stopped watching it also because it was really seeming more and more, first of all, manipulated, and second of all, focused on emotional closure versus just doing what needed to be done for the business of the week and then letting people be babies or not around that process. I was told by TV watchers I trust, including our esteemed colleague Eve Beatty, to get back in. Last episode I watched, which is, all right, we're recording this rather a bit in advance, and this was from last week right now, but it'll be on Hulu. Monica Potter Home. Oh boy. Really did not disappoint. Because Monica Potter sucks. Oh my God. Like, I'm sure she's fine, whatever. But she's, quote, really big into angels, we're told up top. So that's not so much my people.
Oh, good.
She's also my age and she's got the little, like, afro puff hairstyle that's not appropriate for anyone older than half that age. FaceTime me. I want to see everybody's desks. Like, girl, no. And she's like a super like actor hole, passive aggressive control freak of the kind that makes fantastic biz dev TV. And Marcus for once is like, you know, nobody's happy with the situation right now, so I'm just going to leave you $100,000 and go somewhere else that you're not. Good luck. Which is something that he's been reluctant to do in recent seasons, I feel, more so than in the beginning of the show, and which was a smart call. Not so smart, Monica Potter, at least not as smart as she thinks she is, at least about the image that she's putting forward as a mogul. But oh my God, I was riveted. Riveted. So I went back and watched some of the later episodes from last season, and they're just as good. They're really casting with people who have like great ideas but are terrible at execution and also at not fucking lying to Marcus's face and not being dicks. It's great. It's a, you know, fantastic 42 minutes, and I'm glad that I'm getting back into it. It's on Tuesdays on CNBC. If you are out, get back in. Speaking of money, my plug is for my music podcast that I do with Mark Blankenship called Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs. You are not required to become a Patreon subscriber, but Patreon subscribers to the podcast got to pick an album cover that we recreated. So we carefully recreated the cover of Fleetwood Mac's Rumors and retitled it Fleetwood Mastass. My brother, Dave Bunting Jr., took the picture. It is on our Facebook page, which is mastass.podcast, and I encourage you to check it out. There will also be outtakes. This is actually a surprisingly hard pose to do when you're not flexible and don't have good balance like myself.
Haven't done a line of coke before taking the picture like Stevie probably did.
and Stevie, I'm sure, was like captured in motion. We were having to do it like still. I'm like draped over Mark, knocking him over. My brother took pictures of every time I was tipping over, which was like, there were like 100 times. It's pretty funny. And we're going to post those probably. So that's mastass.podcast. And we talk about songs. So if you like songs, check it out.
It is time for the canon. Presenting this week is Mr. Nick Ryan Bell Jones.
Okay, I am presenting season two of Master of None, episode called First Date. Here's a sign of how deep we are into the peak TV era. I would have sworn that the second season of Master of None dropped in January of 2017 because I felt like there were about a billion memorable and critically acclaimed series that came after it. It actually came out in mid-May. and this particular episode isn't necessarily my favorite of the season or ever, but I think it's the most representative of what I like about the show. And I definitely think it's one that can be enjoyed on its own. So if you've never watched an episode of Master of None before, this would be a good one to start with. A lot of Aziz Ansari's stand-up centers around dating and relationships. He collaborated with a sociologist to write a nonfiction book on that subject a couple of years ago. I think it's worth reading. And so an episode about first dates is very much in his wheelhouse. And part of the fun of watching it is see how many experiences and observations he can pack into this 25-minute running time. It's probably not a coincidence that this episode feels tailor-made for the same kinds of short attention spans that have made Tinder and its ilk such huge successes in the dating world. Because essentially the episode channel surfs among a bunch of different first dates, all of which take place in the same locations, all of which feature Dev, the main character played by Aziz. And rarely do we linger on a conversation for more than a minute or two before we zip to the next one. And this chopped up structure keeps us from getting to know the women on the dates all that well. But that, again, I think that's kind of the point. And even for people like me who have not dated in the post-Tinder era, I think there's definitely some familiarity and relatability in the way that the individual dates end up following all these similar patterns and they almost sort of bleed into each other in your mind. So to illustrate, here's one clip where we cycle through four different dates in the span of about 90 seconds.
Can I get a glass of that light red you poured me the other day? You want to try this?
Yeah, sure. So what's the deal with it? Is it special?
Well, apparently the winemaker loves 90s R&B and he plays it throughout the vineyards and it really helps open up the depth of flavor within the grapes. I don't know anything about wine. He's from France. Oh. So how's work going? Everything well?
I'm kind of fun employed right now. Just going out a lot, having a good time.
Oh, so you just going to clubs and getting drunk a lot?
Mm-hmm. Plus my parents are like super rich, so it's like, well, I get a job, right?
Yeah, just keep using their money, right?
After I left LA, I moved to New York, and for the last couple years, I've been working as a lawyer, mostly in the tech industry.
Cool.
What do you do?
I host a competitive cupcake show called Clash of the Cupcakes.
Cool.
I'm out of stuff to say, so I think I'll probably head out.
Okay, well, that was a really fun 5 minutes. I think I'll just grab these drinks then.
All right, bye.
Bye.
So the original Chateau Marmont is in LA, but they just opened up the branch in New York, and that's where I work now.
Is it fun?
No, it's horrible. There's dogs everywhere going crazy.
Whoa. All right, last question. Have any famous dogs stayed there?
Maybe that dog from The Artist might have stayed there once.
What?
So I'll definitely acknowledge that it's certainly possible to argue that this kind of structure endorses a selfish, male-centric attitude toward dating, since Dev is the constant and the women can be seen as interchangeable. And certainly as a man, I'm in no place to argue against that. But I do think the episode at least tries to create some counterbalance to that. And sorry for skipping around chronologically here, but one of the ways it does that is by showing us a very entertaining teaser in which several different women encounter Dev on Tinder, or rather a lawsuit deflecting Tinder knockoff called Love at First Sight. I'm not going to clip it because it's pretty much all visual, but suffice it to say that none of the women is blown away by his profile, and even the ones that do swipe right on him, their attitude is basically, I'll give him a shot. And the punchline comes when Dev gets a notification on his phone that someone has matched with him and he's thrilled. So even though we spend a majority of the episode locked into his point of view, that opening segment helps to cut his ego down to size, even if it's only the audience that knows about it. There's also a nice interlude about 10 minutes into the episode in which all the female characters are given a chance to vent about the creepy things that men do on Tinder, and let's hear that clip.
I mean, I also get that, like, really gross, like, disgusting stuff, too, a lot.
Like what?
Well, like, there was the guy who was like, hey, just come on over and we'll fuck on my hammock.
A guy sent me his penis and was like, this is my penis.
Fetishy Indian stuff.
Fetishy Latina stuff.
Fetishy short Filipino girl stuff.
One guy texted me a picture of a handwritten letter.
That seems nice.
It just said, what up with them big old titties? And permanent marker.
Oh, that's not as nice.
And then he drew two big old titties.
Oh, being a black woman on these apps? Completely different situation. I mean, compared to my white friends, I get way less activity. I also find that I rarely match with guys outside of my race.
Same for me. A lot of my matches are Indian women. I did read somewhere that the people that do worst on the apps are Asian men and black women.
Well, it's great white people finally have an advantage somewhere. Cheers to that.
To white people.
So that last bit was definitely an example of Aziz injecting some of his aforementioned sociological research into the dialogue. But I think it's forgivable there since it's part of one of the episode's most empathetic moments and definitely helps to lend more dimension to the storytelling than you get from a typical rom-com series. In general, as each parallel evening progresses, we start to see Dev and his dates decide how honest they're willing to be with each other, which to me is also a very relatable element. I think most of us have been on first dates where the other person said something or did something or revealed something that caused us to more or less write them off within the first 20 minutes or even less than that. But we keep on making polite conversation until the drinks are finished and we can feel justified in calling it a night. On Dev's date with Priya, who's played by Tia Sirkar, aka Real Eleanor from The Good Place, there's a moment where Priya steps away for a long time to take a phone call, and rather than let it go by, as we've seen him do with other kind of red flaggy moments, he's honest about being annoyed, but he forgives her once she offers to buy a bottle of wine for them to make up for her absence. And I'm not saying that his reaction is particularly appealing, but it's clear that his willingness to express frustration and even hold a little bit of a grudge comes from the fact that he's feeling a real connection to this woman, which means that she now has the power to hurt his feelings. And I should say here, one of the fun things about watching the episode a second time is getting the chance to really play armchair sociologist by analyzing the individual dates a little more closely. Like, you see clear differences in the dynamics of each date, different lengths of pauses in conversations, different levels of comfort or desperation in the jokes that Dev is making, different body language, different posture, all of that. After a brief walking down the street interlude that includes some more fun vignettes, a white guy brawl, a lollipop-toting businessman, and a heartfelt reunion between one of Dev's dates and a boringly handsome war photographer with whom Dev jokingly and unsuccessfully tries to measure professional dicks, we move on to a second location, a trendy rooftop bar with stunning views and one of many examples of Master of None's impressive dedication to New York location porn. It's here that Dev becomes intrigued by something he discovers about Stephanie, played by the fantastic comedian Aparna Nancherla, and let's hear that clip.
So I'm sitting in front of the PS4, look at the clock, realize I'm 8 hours deep into an Overwatch sesh. I'm starving by then, so I go over to my ramen place, Mr. Taka.
I know Mr. Taka. That place is good.
Oh, it's delicious. I love their chicken ramen. It has these really nice yuzu lemon notes. Big fan of yuzu. I wrote this whole article about it for my blog.
Wait, I read that article. Are you the raw maniac?
Yeah, but keep it on the DL, man. I gotta protect my secret identity to have integrity for my blog.
Yeah.
I can't go to ramen restaurants, have people start recognizing me. The chef's gonna come out, ask me for my photo. I don't know. It's a whole thing.
I get it, sure. I am a fan. I read all the reviews. I have it on my bookmarks toolbar.
Oh, that's nice. It's great to meet a fan. We should go get ramen together sometime.
That'd be fun. I'll come clean. I always assumed the raw maniac was a man.
Oh, I get that. I've been told my writing style has a masculine energy to it. You know, like Hemingway or Bukowski.
By the way, if you've never seen Aparna Nancherla do stand-up, see her do stand-up. She just has such a like unique comedic perspective and personality
really
and everything.
Yeah, she's
so funny. But anyway, Dev's budding romantic interest in Stephanie is cut short when he finds out she has a boyfriend and just uses the dating app to make friends. And in the end, only one of the many dates ends with an honest-to-goodness hookup, although that particular date with Christine, played by Lauren Miller-Rogan, is not without its own complications. Dev is in bed with Christine, reaching for a condom when he sees an appallingly racist glass figurine on the nightstand, but of course he waits until after sex to bring the issue up, which leads to this clip.
Hey, random question. What's up with the jar?
It's, just a gift that a friend gave me.
Isn't it a little racist?
Racist?
You can't use that shade of black to depict African-American people.
No one else has ever been offended by it.
Have any black people seen it?
I haven't had any African-American guests.
So I'm the person with the darkest skin tone that's seen it, and I'm the most offended? Don't I see a correlation there?
So you think I'm racist now, but you still had sex with me?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I was kind of caught up in the moment.
Don't you think that's hypocritical?
I mean, it definitely doesn't reflect well on my principles, no.
I think you should go.
Well, just show it to a black person sometime. That's all I'm asking. This is all coming from a good place. I don't know what else to...
Get out of my apartment.
Yeah. All right.
And the episode ends with Dev coming home, slumping down into his couch and taking out his phone to discover that he has 3 new matches on the dating app, so it's time to start the cycle all over again. Like I said, I think this episode really shows off the strengths of Master of None. I liked the show a lot in its first season, and it got even more confident and creative and honest in season 2. And First Date has a lot going for it. It's honest, funny, beautifully shot. It puts Dev in a relatable position while showcasing enough obvious flaws and bad choices to keep him distinct and 3-dimensional. The quasi-Groundhog Day structure keeps the episode breezy, even if it's exploring a lot of genuine issues. And I think that's a balance that this series has always done a good job of striking. That's all I have to say, so let me know if you need anything from Whole Foods.
Sarah, why don't you go first?
I have never watched Master of None before. I was basically told by one of the... like one of my pop cultural canaries in the coal mine of culture, that it's like, that this is not for you. You won't like it. I liked this a lot, though. My dating life was also pre-Tinder, but not that long ago, and a lot of this was uncomfortably true. And like the some of the lines about like the shrink ray that missed the lollipop and. Just the delivery of some of these like particularly poor matches, like this amped up cupcakes lady who's like, siblings, tell me. It was very sharply observed, which I think is the selling point of the series. But I don't know how typical it is, so I don't have context for that. And this was a perfectly enjoyable half an hour that made me want to read his book on this, but then like as far as watching another episode, I was like, no, I'm set. So I'm not sure how I'm gonna vote, but if this is sort of like, I don't, you guys will have to tell me if this is typical of the series and whether you think I should investigate it further, but as a just like general commentary on dating in this city and at this technological time, it was uncomfortable to watch at times, but I thought really, really well done. Dave.
I remember when we lived in New York, we saw Aziz do stand up while he was working on, which I think is like one thing, if he could dig a hole and put part of his career in that hole, he should. And that's Randy. Oh God, I hated that so much. He was working on a set, and then he was basically, you know, tuning that character for, it was for a movie or something, right?
It was for funny
the
people.
Judd Apatow movie. Yeah,
that's so, right. Yeah. That's what I think about that.
There you go.
But his stand-up is really funny. I think he's great comedic voice. He was obviously great on Parks and Rec, and this is sort of like his character in this episode is like, 30%. Tom from Parks and Rec, but it's like Tom in the real world. This is the character he would be sort of in this episode. Yeah.
Well, Tom would also definitely have a standard opener line for, whatever app he's using. Sure. That's a very Tom thing.
So you can see what Aziz brought into, you know, these characters, what he brought of himself into it. I thought this was, God, I'm so glad that I don't have to like go to bars or do the speed dating crap or anything like that. Yeah. Tara, if we ever get divorced, I'm just going to jump in the ocean and die.
Yeah, same.
it's like dating and going to university. Like once you realize you don't have to do it anymore, you're like, yes. Like this is just my nightmare. This episode, just like having to do all this stuff, it's just the worst. But I thought like. You know, the pacing was like ba-dump, 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 and it worked really well. And I thought like the episode flew by. For something I've never watched before, you know, I wasn't lost. I wasn't checking my watch. You know, it's not uproariously funny. It's just sort of like, you know, funny and a little heartfelt, and it works really well. And I think that's a good place to be for Aziz. You know, I think he's hit the right balance there. What's the comedian's name?
Aparna Ninchurla.
Yeah. Oh God, she's so funny. I love her and everything she's in. What was the stand-up special we watched, Tara? Was that just a Comedy Central?
I was going to mention that in mine too. It's a Comedy Central half hour, so you can find it on the app, and you should. It's really
okay. Good. Yeah, definitely.
You should
hunt
also
that
follow
down.
Her on Twitter.
Yeah, she's hilarious.
She's like
on
the
Twitter.
Perfect comedian to follow. She's not an over tweeter, and yeah, she's not trying too hard. That can you can run into some of that.
Yeah, she's also great as BoJack Horseman's daughter on the latest season of that as well.
Yeah. All right, well, Tara, I'll let you take over before we vote.
Okay, I think I've watched the most of this show of everyone. I watched the first three or four of season one, and the reason that I checked out was that I have a problem with amateur actors. And in those episodes, the Aziz has his real dad playing his character's dad on the show.
Oh yeah.
And he's not an actor, which is like, fine. No one has to be an actor, but like maybe cast an actor. It's a crazy thought. But I also think that Aziz is not a great actor either. I do think he's really funny, but that was another problem that I had with the show, which is that he just seems like him. And like, I realize this is probably a very loosely fictionalized version of his real self, particularly given what Nick said about, you know, his dating book and stuff. So like, this seems like a place for him to play out some of those ideas, which I think is fine. That said, my other problem I do think Nick makes a great point about this episode in particular and why it's a smart choice was that, that it does puncture the idea of having him as the hero. He's not really the hero of the episode. I mean, he has his moments, but like you said, they do things to undercut him as, you know, the lens through which we're seeing this. He is, but at the same time, the women get a fair amount of agency as well for just being in it because they happen to match on this app. And, my problem with a lot of shows that were sort of, you know, post Sex in the City shows, but from the dude perspective, like I'm thinking of that extremely short-lived John Stamos show, Jake in Progress. Although since we're here, grandfathered had that problem too. Like or Hello Ladies, the most egregious example of this, which is you can't tell a story like an underdog story about a love life from the dominant sex. Like, sorry, that's just not how it works. Like, it's not interesting to see it from the overdog perspective. And a man obviously is always going to be in that perspective, a straight man. But I do think this episode was really well done. As Dave said, the pacing is great. It's fun to cycle through and see like the various stages and the progress of a date, like which ones make it to the roof, the roof bar, which ones end in making out in the car and like how you decide whether you're going to hook up or not and stuff. And wasn't the condom actually in the racist cookie jar?
Yeah, it was.
Okay. It's just like, that's such an amazing detail that you have to think like, who did this actually happen to?
Because there's a way it didn't.
You know what I mean?
Come from real life, totally. Yeah.
So I wasn't, when you picked it, I was like, oh, you're crazy for this one, Nick. But I was happy to watch it. And it actually made me want to go back and give season one a second try. Because I definitely read that season two was great. So thank you for bringing it to us.
Thank you. I knew this was going to be me. I knew this was going to be me like flying down the wormhole of the thing, but I'm glad that it got this good of a response. So let's see.
Yep.
All right. Let's make it official. Sarah D. Bunting.
I am on the fence, but man, if only because it really made me appreciate even more being married to my husband.
All the single people listening to this episode are like, fuck you.
Yeah. Been there. And also I think that there is a little bit of smugness that Ansari has that this undercuts nicely, that's what tends to put me off his stuff. And that's not as much in evidence here, or he's making fun of it. So I'm going to vote yes.
I will also vote yes. Tara Ariana.
Me too.
All right. Master of None, Season 2, Episode 4, First Date. You are hereby inducted into the Extra. Talk Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time for Winner and Loser of the Year.
Yes, we are pre-taping this episode, so by the time it comes out on January 3rd, let's be honest, we might all be dead. So we can't pick anything topical.
So if something super terrible or super amazing has happened in the world of television between December 21st and January 1st, that's why it's not been mentioned here.
Yeah, sorry. so instead, we're doing a winner and loser of the year that was 2017. And my choice for winner is Late Night with Seth Meyers. I wrote about this a little bit. I was lucky enough to be included in Slate's year-end TV club. But the Trump era, I guess, I wish it was the post-Trump era, the Trump era, has really been I hate to say a great thing for comedy, but it really has helped Late Night with Seth Meyers define itself as more than the show that Fred Armisen is never on, even though he's supposedly the man later. They've come up with some great segments to respond to stuff that's happening. A Closer Look is always it's like their post monologue section where they do sort of a deep dive, except a funnier version of what John Oliver does on Last Week Tonight. And they must be writing them like up to 5 minutes before they go on the air. And they're always really sharp and funny and great. Meyers' impression of Trump has gotten better, which is also a side benefit. And it's also this year they've really showcased a lot of their women writers who are also performers. Amber Ruffin in particular, who's spectacular. She got a segment called Amber Says What, which is just her reading headlines and then being like, what, or putting different inflections on it. It's funnier when she does it, obviously. Late Night with Seth Meyers has really found its voice this year in a very exciting way. And I loved it. And that's my winner of the year.
And Sarah, who is loser of the year? And I have a guess, but I'll let you reveal it.
Dicks.
Dicks.
Literal and figurative. Please tell me. You have a sound drop for us. Anyone?
Dick.
Yeah.
There it is. Grabby, rapey, harassy, wage gappy dudes.
Yep.
You getting it now. Fuck off. So, yeah. I hope that this continues until all of these dicks are out of everyone's system, as it were.
Yep.
Speaking about things, getting things out of your system. Didn't know that was the end of it. Do you know what time it is?
Dick time. Dick time?
No, it's not dick time. It's just game time.
It's always dick time.
Oh.
I have no idea if you can hear it on tape because I tried to sneeze into my shoulder. But about 10 seconds before that last segment ended, I had one of those sneezes that makes you instantly need to take a nap. I'm just letting you know right now, this game time might get a little interesting. All right. So I was told to keep this game time short because of Black Mirror discussion. We knew it was going to go long. So this is the fifth time game time of the season. The scores are Tara 3, Sarah 1, Value Guess 1. What's the chompy steel meal situation, Tara?
Let me check. Good question.
Yes. Let's find out about all them.
I think we each got one last week, yeah?
Yes. Sarah has one. I have one. Valued guests have two.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
There you go. Today we are playing the United States of Television, part one. I split this game into two parts so that we can get out of here on time. From Suli, who earns himself an extra credit. Redeemable for an extra hot, great mini topic of his choosing. I will read you the description of a TV show that marries an existing show with one of the 50 states of the union, and you tell me the new title. For example,
okay.
Zooey Deschanel is a surprisingly abrasive and over-tanned lead in this comedy where she moves into an apartment with three men in Atlantic City.
New Jersey Girl.
New Jersey Girl, and that's how we play this game. All right. Make sense? Any questions?
No.
All right, so we got 24 questions today. We'll play part two in the new year. Let's throw it to Picky, but this is a complete game. Points will be awarded at the end of the day.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
We will start with Tara.
All right, Tara, mm-hmm. Nika, Sarah is our order. Are we ready to play the United States of Television part one?
Yes, sir.
Here you go, Tara.
Okay.
A 60s era Tarzan knockoff cartoon in which a dim-witted southern plantation-owning gentleman lives in a tropical forest.
Georgia of the Jungle.
Correct.
For 1 point, right?
Correct. Everything's just 1 point today.
Got it.
For Nick, MTV presents their newest show in which the rapper Xzibit... Do you like that? How I had to... Like, what is this crazy Dave?
Zibit, comma X.
It's Mr. Zibit to you.
Is he like a robot frog? Zibit. All right. The guitar mode to recuperate. In which the rapper Exhibit. There, how's that? Rehabs an entire state, making rundown, dated theme park rides come to life, sprucing up retirement communities with bling, and aiding hurricane victims by giving them fake grills.
Pimp My Florida.
Yes, Pimp My Florida.
Nice.
All right, first one for Sarah. Every week, contestants binge eat Creole food and then dress up like a boot and try to look like the largest human version of their great state.
Then dress up like a boot?
Each week, contestants binge eat Creole food, then dress up like a boot and try to look like the largest human version of their great state.
Biggest Louisiana?
Oh, biggest Louisiana, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
All right, Titara.
Yeah.
The dark and twisted trials of two backwoods bluegrass plastic surgeons.
Nip, Kentucky? Oh,
nice. Nip, Kentucky.
Okay.
Nice.
Okay.
CBS had decided to revive this cold early 90s medical dramedy. This time, Dr. Fleischman is forced to open his practice in Fargo.
Fleischman. Ew.
Yeah. Well, what are you going to do, eh?
Oh,
yeah. Northern Dakota exposure. An FBI agent and his handsome former nemesis turned partner work together to solve high income crimes in the Rocky Mountains.
White Colorado.
A web series turned HBO show, which tells the stories of various people who are all tangentially connected to a weed dealer in Augusta.
Hi, Maine with an E, tenants.
Showtime's stunning spy thriller about potato farming espionage in Yellowstone.
Ida Homeland.
The next season of this ensemble cast scary anthology style storytelling will be about how after Dorothy returned home, Auntie M institutionalized her and the Wicked Witch of the Farther West crossed into our world and dropped a house on Dorothy's sister.
Well, I know it's Kansas, but then I don't know which anthology series it's going to be. Once Upon a Topeka? I don't actually know.
Oh!
Someone should steal.
Steal Bill!
Yeah.
Amerikansas Horror Story.
That is correct.
Oh! Nice.
All right. Back to Tara.
Yep.
A quirky, possibly slightly unstable woman leaves her high-powered New York lawyer job, puts on her 10-gallon hat, buys a handgun, becomes a lawyer for an oil tycoon, and begins wearing cowboy boots with spurs all to rekindle a childhood summer camp romance.
Crazy Tex-Girlfriend.
Crazy Tex. Excuse me. Okay, to Nick. A spinoff of a hit ABC show in which country singers move to the land of Lincoln to try create a new country music capital in Peoria.
I know you watched
this show.
Nashville, Illinois.
Okay. Nashville, Illinois. An updated version of the 1970s game show now shot in Portland, where hipsters of various talent compete before a panel of celebrity judges.
Oregon show?
Bernie Sanders and a group of maple syrup farmers do British-style sketch comedy.
Oh, for Monty Python's Flying Circus.
Correct. This is for Sarah.
Nope, this is for Nick.
And by Sarah, I mean Nick. The royal personage of Will Smith is sent into exile in the Grand Canyon.
Let's see.
I think if you say the title, there's really only
Fresh
one way.
Prince of Bel-Air. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Arizona.
Thank God.
Correct. It took a while. We're all thinking it. Okay, Sarah, into our score break. Our one and only Gross Worth Eater Challenge Zone awaits. Cartoon Network is trying its hand at a new revival as the mystery van cruises through southern New England, solving mysteries and trying to find their dog.
Southern New England?
Yeah.
Southern New England. Okay. Is there part of this title that I don't...
Maybe.
...remember? Scooby-Doo-Laware? No, that's not my answer. unless that's correct. Southern New England?
We're gonna need an answer here.
Uh-huh.
Anybody?
Someone steal it, because
no,
I don't know how.
No.
Scooby-Doo, Delaware, are you?
That is
I was thinking Scooby-Doo, Hampshire.
That is a mid-Atlantic state. I object.
Score break, please.
Okay. I have 6, Nick has 5, Sarah has 3.
Take it up with Sully. I'm sorry, who's last?
Sarah.
Sarah.
New England and Old Man Cole Light on. Who, this is classics, what watch dropped from a plane and was found still ticking thousands of feet below in a TV ad?
Timex?
Woo!
What Three's Company character often walked around in a loosely tied towel?
Chrissy?
I was going to be like, all of them?
Drama. What type of law does ladies' man Arnie Becker specialize in on L.A. law?
Matrimonial and divorce law.
Sarah!
All right, here you... What was our sweep? It was like double points?
Sure.
No, sweep was you're automatically tied for first or something like that. Does that sound right?
I don't remember, points. But sure, let's do that.
All right.
Okay.
What did Mouseketeers have fun with in quotes, on Mondays? Kids and games.
Homework?
Music. What newswoman did what newsman did ABC lure away from NBC? Somehow there was ABC and NBC in that question, and I said CBS. What newswoman did ABC lure away from NBC in 76 with a $1 million per year offer?
Baba Wawa.
What shows guest hosts have included Ralph Nader, Ron Nessen, and Candace Bergen? What shows guest hosts included those people?
Tonight Show?
Saturday Night Live. But well
done. What was
done.
The answer to the Mouseketeer one?
Music.
Music.
Oh, music. Okay.
That's worth 2 points. 2 points added to your tally.
I'll take
All right.
Them.
Back to the game. This is for
me.
Tara Ariano. A semi-silent Vegas magician partners up with an entire Quaker state to debunk various ideas and conceptions held by the general populace.
Oh, God. Pennsylvania and Teller's bullshit.
Number 17.
Pretty cool.
NBC is rebooting an old 90s show, Paul and Jamie Buckman, married now for over a decade, pull up stakes to become Mormon and move to the Southwest, and are just gaga for their new home.
Mad about Utah.
As we all are at one time.
Oops. That's not right. Doesn't matter. Bob Saget narrates as a father who recounts how his wife first encountered this great state of corn and presidential caucuses.
How Iowa met your mother?
Fox beloved 90s sitcom featuring young women and two men as they navigate unmarried life while eating cheese and cheering for the Packers.
I know the state, but I can't remember the show. It's Wisconsin something.
Anybody? That's Living Wisconsin-gle. Four women and one man open up an interior decorating firm in the land of 1,000 Lakes. Things get a little awkward when they are hired to redecorate the home of their recently disgraced senator.
Designing Wim, Minnesota.
Correct. It's Tool Time on the Old Indian Reservation. ABC is reimagining this 90s sitcom with Native American cast living on reservation land in the late 1880s. The affable father of three boys owns a local repair shop where he does classes in how to set up your dwelling for both entertainment and practicality.
Are there any states that are repeated?
I don't think so.
Because I want to say Idaho Home Improvement, but we already used Idaho.
Yeah, let me give you a little hint here. I guess this is like connected to the Trail of Tears and whatnot.
Right.
Navajo Home Improvement?
That's not a state.
Should be. Well, that's not it. I don't know.
Anybody?
Steel Meal? Nick? Steel?
No? No, I... Oklahoma Improvement.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Here's everybody's last question coming up. Quick score break, please, Tara.
Okay, Nick and I are tied with 7 each. Sarah has 6.
Okay. Anybody's game? Yet another installment of the Netflix extensions of this beloved Wayne Showalter camp saga. This time, the camp is forced to move to Nashville yet another decade later.
Wet, hot Tennessee American summer? I don't know.
Oh, the answer we want is definitely in the hint. This time the camp is forced to move to Nashville yet another decade later.
Okay. Oh, right. Wet, hot American summer, Tennessee years later.
All right, this is for Nick. For a baker's dozen episodes, local residents of this state record justifications for their state's existence on cassette tapes, such as it being the first state to give women the vote.
13 Reasons Wyoming.
13 Reasons Wyoming, correct.
Nicely done.
All right, our last question. Three couples from Baltimore are matched by experts and engage in holy matrimony upon first meeting.
Married land at first sight.
Married land at first sight. Nice. Correct. All right. So Tara and Nick are tied, correct?
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. It was a very close game.
Here is the tiebreaker. First person to shout out the answer after I've read the question will win.
Okay.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Here we go. I get to pick one. Which one will I pick? Do, 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 do. All right. Here we go. Are you ready?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. FX has decided to renew this series for an 8th season and retcon out the previous finale. Jax, now 5 years later, has been living a quiet life in Glacier National Park, but has decided to restart his motorcycle gang to hunt down litterers and poachers of bison.
Sons of Arkansas key?
Sons of Montanarchy?
Tara.
Congratulations, Tara. Nail biter.
Well, yeah, that was fun.
United States of Tara.
Well, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We reflected on the fourth season of Black Mirror before going around the dial with stops at Grow-ish, whatever Nick did, which was
Marvel's Runaways.
You can always tell when I make my notes before or after people put in their shows. And The Prophet. Nick scored on his first date canon submission. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
fetishy Canadian girl stuff,
Sarah D. Bunting.
It's any button. They're all the same.
And Nick Ridewell Jones.
Please, Mr. Zibbet was my father.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Extra Hot Great.
Stick us in hyperwarp and let's fuck off somewhere.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.